This is the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. Today is March 14th, 2006. It's approximately 10:20 a.m. We're at the UAW Local 602 Frank Dreyer Greenhouse. First, we'll introduce the team.
Marilyn Colt.
John Fedewa.
Doug Rademacher.
Gary Judy.
Earl Nicholson.
Jerry Smith.
And I'm Cheryl McQuaid. Today we're interviewing Richard Bennett. Dick, will you please state your name and spell it for us?
Well, I went by C. Richard Bennett when I was working in the plant. C stands for Charles, C-H-A-R-L-E-S, Richard, R-I-C-H-A-R-D, Bennett, B-E-N-N-E-T-T.
And what is your address?
Currently living at 11954 South Starlake Drive, Baldwin, Michigan, 49304.
And are you married?
Yes, I am.
How many children do you have?
I have six children of my own and four stepchildren.
Where were you born and raised, Dick?
Well, I was born in Hastings, Michigan. And I was raised in many places. My dad was a metallurgist in the missile industry, and because of the type of work he did, we did a lot of moving. I went to 14 schools in 13 years. But most of it was in Michigan, but I did live in North Carolina for 3 years. And those were probably my most formative years, of those 3 years I lived in North Carolina.
What is your educational level?
Graduated from high school in Hastings, wound up back in Hastings, and graduated from there.
And were you in the military at all?
No. I had gotten in a bad automobile accident, and I wasn't able to go into service.
Could you tell us a little bit about your work history before hiring into Fisher Body?
Well, I started working on farms for all the farmers around the area when I was about 13 years old. And I stayed busy pretty much every day of the summer, all the time I was off from school. And when I was 15 years old, I hired into a place in Battle Creek called Spring Hill Nursing Home. It was a brand new facility at that time. Hired in there as a dishwasher in the kitchen. Worked there a few months, and they asked me if I'd be interested in going out and starting working on the floor as an orderly. So they trained me as an orderly, and I started working there. And from there, they asked me if I'd be interested in working in physical therapy. So I did that for a while, up until the time I quit there. And that was, I'd been there about 16 months when I quit, grand total. And when I quit there, I went to work for a burial vault company in Battle Creek called Wilbert Burial Vault. So I went from trying to save lives to burying people. And I worked at Wilbert for just a very short time and had an opportunity to start working construction, which was considerably more money. So I went to work for Fastdex Construction Company out of Walled Lake, Michigan. And we built ramp parking lots at that time. And I worked there up until I got laid off for the winter. And at that time, I was graduated from high school, but I had to lie my age because I was only 17 and had to be 18 to work construction. So oddly enough, I had to keep dodging the union guy that kept coming around checking on things, make sure they didn't have no illegal workers. But anyway, I survived on that job up until they laid me off for the winter months. And after that, I started working for a fellow by the name of Chuck Dockstader. He had his own business laying carpet. And so I worked with him. And we worked together for quite a long time. We had 23 different carpet suppliers we had supplying us with the carpet. And suddenly Teamsters went on strike, and we couldn't get any carpet for 3 weeks. And I had a wife and a child to support at that time, and I couldn't go 3 weeks without working because I needed the money. So after 3 weeks, I started looking for a job. But in the meantime, a friend of mine was working at Fisher Body in Lansing, and he brought me home an application. Well, I had gone ahead and filled that out and sent it back with him, and Fisher Body had sent me what they call a mailogram, and I ignored it because in the meantime, I'd already been hired in and out of Grand Trunk Railroad in Battle Creek, and I'd also been hired in and out of Eaton Manufacturing in Battle Creek and Clark Equipment in Battle Creek. All three good jobs. But when they x-rayed me, they'd see where my pelvis was all smashed to pieces when I was in that accident. So they wouldn't take a chance on me and hire me. So I just figured there's no sense of going to Fisher Body because they're going to do the same thing. So I just ignored it. Well, by the time the Teamsters were on strike and I'd been out of work for 3 weeks, Fisher Body had sent me 3 mailograms, one a month for 3 months. Well, Chuck Dockstader, that I was working with, had worked for Chevrolet over in Flint years before that. So he said, well, let's go up there to Lansing. He said, I'll take you. I said, I don't even know where Lansing's at. I have no idea where that's at. He said, well, I'll take you up there. And he said, maybe they'll let me put in my application while we're up there. I said, all right. So we came to Lansing. They gave me a physical. They didn't x-ray me, and they took his application, and when I got done going down to the plant hospital and getting my physical, I went back to the employment line there, and they were interviewing a number of people, and I talked to, I can't think of Jeff's last name. Wound up being in suggestions later
Andros.
On. Jeff Andros, yes. Talked to Jeff Andros, and he hired me. And asked me if I wanted to go to work on nights that night or days the next day. And I said, I need a job right now. I'll go to work on nights tonight. He said, okay, come in tomorrow morning. That was my first taste of how things go at Fisher Body. So I started there April 30th, 1968, and worked the production line. It was interesting because the first thing they put me on was cleaning up cars at the end of the line, just wiping them down with oleum, taking kind of spot, cleaning them, and getting them ready to ship over to Oldsmobile to have the body and the chassis put together. So I worked about a week with a bunch of older folks. They had a, kind of what they call the old folks home there. That's what those people did. And we had two lines running parallel to each other at the time. So they liked the way I worked with them. So they, when they was management was going to put me over on the regular production line, put me on a regular production job, they tried to fight that. They tried to keep me there till the folks home. But that didn't work out too good. With the new hire, they're going to put you to work. So I went over and I was up in building 3X second and just kept going from job to job until they finally gave me a job. And once I landed on a regular job, I decided I didn't like doing the same thing over and over every day. So then I went to utility voluntarily. A lot of people didn't like utility, but I liked it because I got to do something different every day. Got to meet a lot of people that way. Got to learn a lot of jobs.
Dick, why did a lot of people not like utility?
Well, because you had to do something different every day. Some people are not really adaptable to doing that. Some people would just want to learn a job. Those jobs are very difficult. People don't realize or didn't realize at that time, and still don't, I think, just how difficult it is working in an auto assembly plant. You know, you hear about that, and you hear some of these... Well, there was an old country song talking about being the number one washer crammer in the whole shock absorber division. You know, sounds so simple and stuff like that. It wasn't simple. You had to do a whole lot of hard work. Anybody that worked there knew that. And you had to be able to adapt. If you had to do a different job every day, you're using different muscles every day, you're having to do all different kinds of things, learn different kind of things, deal with somebody new, not only in management, but production, on the production line. So it was difficult for a lot of people. But I like doing that kind of stuff. Other people like just learning one thing and sticking to it.
And you mentioned that you worked in 3x second. Could you tell us a little bit of what is 3x second?
Well, at that time, I guess 3x second was the newest building that had been built on at Fisherbein. I guess it was about 16 years old at that time. But 3x second was where they did the soft trim. Of course, the job started down in the basement in the body shop at that time, and then they went on up into the paint shop, and then they went from the paint shop on up into what we called trim hardware, and then finally they went up into 3X second where you did all the soft trim, the interior trim, things like that, the final trim before it was sent over to Oldsmobile to be married to the chassis.
Doug Rademacher.
Dick, you said you came up here with a partner. Did he happen to get hired in?
No, he didn't. He was 50-some years old at that time, and Vietnam War was going pretty good still, and they had a need for people, but they really weren't, looking for older people. When there was younger people available, that's what they wanted.
The other thing I was going to ask you is, you mentioned that you walked into the plant and they gave you a cleanup. You said you worked with oleum. What exactly was oleum?
Well, I don't know what the chemical makeup of it was, but it was, I guess, some kind of solvent or something that they would wipe the bodies down on the car. But I know it would really eat at your hands if you didn't wear rubber gloves. You didn't want to do too much work with it barehanded.
And were the gloves you mentioned, were they supplied, or did you have to request them, or was there a concern for people at that time?
Well, we had an elderly lady at that time. Her name was Sally, that worked in that area. And part of her responsibility, she was kind of overseeing. She had to work on the line with us, but she kind of overseen that whole thing as well. We didn't really have a foreman that did a lot around there for us. She was kind of fell on her, and every day when we got to work, she would go ahead and get the gloves that we needed for the day and all that kind of stuff, and then she would make sure you had all those, whatever it is you needed, the oleum, the gloves, anything that was necessary for the job.
Now, you said you didn't know where Lansing was, and you found out through your partner, he brought you up here. You told the guy you wanted to work nights, I'm assuming that you were ready to work, but which shift did you end up on, and how far did you drive, and how did you get here? Did you carpool? Things like that.
Well, I drove at that time. It was about 48 miles one way. And it was kind of interesting because I didn't know where Lansing was, and I was trying to remember how we got there because Chuck didn't get hired in. So the next morning, I took off real early to make sure I was going to be here in plenty of time, and it was a good thing because I come in on 27 between Charlotte and Lansing, and I knew I had to go left on Waverly Road. So I got to the light, I went left. The thing I'd forgotten is we turned right on Saginaw Highway. I didn't realize that, and I went clear to the end of Waverly Road, wound out there by the airport. So now I'm starting to panic. I don't know where I'm at or how I'm going to get back to where the plant is. I don't know how to get there. And here's my first day. I don't want to be late because I'm thinking they're going to fire me for sure. So I turned around, and I just kept driving slowly until I got back to Saginaw. Of course, that was a wide, wide road, so I decided, well, that might have been where we turned. So I turned left and went on down there, and by golly, there was Fisher Body up there on the right. But then I didn't know where to go to park. So I parked out in front of the plant. And fortunately, I don't know why, but I didn't get a ticket that day, but I was parked up in front of the plant. So I didn't know how to get in the plant other than the front entrance, because that's where I had to go to get interviewed and hired. Well, after I got in the plant and started working that first day, I said, you know, how do I get to my car when the shift's over? And they said, just follow the crowd. Follow the crowd. They're going right out to that parking lot. Well, up in 3X Second, everybody parked out here in the south lot. I was parked out front. So I followed the crowd and wound up in a big old strange parking lot. Then I didn't have any idea where in the world I was at. That plant was huge to me. I mean, later on it became a lot larger because they kept adding on. But at that time, it was like a whole city within itself. And take a little country boy like me, I was just lost.
Well, that was my next question, is that you had a vast amount of work experience outside before you came in. Can you just share that feeling of when they walked you out to the assembly line? What would that look like, and can you describe that?
Well, I tell you, years later, I went to New York City, and it was kind of the same feeling. When I walked out in that plant and seen how big, and this was only 3X Second I was looking at, but when they walked me up through hardware to get to the 3X Second, I thought, wow, this is enormous. I hadn't even seen the body shop or the paint shop or the cushion room at that time, because at that time we still had the cushion room. So I didn't even see half of the plant, but I thought it was just like a whole new, another world. It was huge.
Were you a little bit afraid of working on automobiles, or what was your feeling?
Well, I was real, real nervous, you know. I had never done that kind of work before. I'd never worked in a factory. In fact, years before that, I said, I'll never work in a factory. I loved being outdoors. I loved working outdoors. I loved working hard. And so I couldn't see myself ever being in a factory. So, yeah, I was real nervous. And especially because I don't know anybody. I don't know the town. I don't know the plant. And it was just completely new. Everything was completely new to me.
Now, with that in mind, did you make that 48-mile trip one way every day by yourself? Or did you say 58 or 48?
48.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I did it for about 2 years by myself. And there was a supervisor at that time that I became friends with. His name was George Ruffner. And George lived over by Hastings. So George and I started carpooling. And he usually worked. I always wound up working the long line, whichever line worked the longest. Back in those days, we didn't have any restrictions on overtime, but there was a state law that wouldn't let women work, I believe it was over 54 or 56 hours a week. So come Saturday, we'd already gotten the hours in. Women couldn't come in and work Saturdays normally because they'd already gotten their 54 or 56 hours in. So they'd shut one production line down on Saturday and shift everybody over to the other one. Because normally we were, at that time, we were working like between 11 and 11.4 hours a day on the production line. And that was 6 days a week. Sometimes on Saturdays we'd get out in 8 hours, but I'll never forget the first day I worked 8 hours. It was like I only worked a half a shift. I couldn't believe it. In fact, I blew my truck up going home that day. I left the shop, and it was so early in the afternoon, I wasn't used to that, and I thought, it was a beautiful sunny day, and I thought, I'm just going to take my time and drive slow. I had an old Beater Dodge truck at that time. Looked like a semi. It was a cab over the engine job. So I probably didn't go over 45 miles an hour all the way home. Just took my time, and I got into Hastings, and all of a sudden, water shot up the stack. And I'd busted the, or I'd cracked the block, blew the truck up. But that put some long hours in back in those days.
Marilyn Coulter, Dick, outside of the size of it, was there anything else about the plant that might have shocked you or surprised you when you came in there?
Well, back at that time, I can tell you there was, there were women that worked there, but very few younger women. There was quite a few ladies that were elderly, or I figured elderly at that time. Of course, if you was 55, 60 years old at that time, I thought you were elderly. I don't think that way anymore. But a lot of them ladies had hired in back during the wartime. when they couldn't get men. Mm-hmm. And then there was quite a long period of time, I guess, that they didn't do a lot of hiring as far as women were concerned. But they had just started hiring some women at that time, so there was a few women in there, probably around my age, but not very many. And I thought that was kind of strange, you know, for that big of an operation. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't get over the amount of people that worked there. I mean, I never imagined that many people working in one place. Mm-hmm. I wasn't used to working with over a few dozen people at the very most.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Earl Nicholson.
So you hired in. You're in this huge factory. You didn't see a whole lot of women. Did you see any other minority groups? Did you see blacks? Did you see Mexicans? Did you see Asians?
There were blacks and Mexicans, not too many. But other than that, no. I mean, Asians and stuff like that, you didn't see a lot of that. Not at that time. But later on, of course, that changed.
So how was the interaction between the different groups?
Well, you know, I guess to me, I got along with everybody I ran into pretty much until I started getting political and getting involved with the union. Then sometimes you don't get along with people because you can't do everything they want you to. But as far as the interaction between myself and others, I really got along great. In fact, I worked production for 9 years before I ever decided to get involved with the union. And it happened that a friend of mine was a Mexican, and I was working on the big station wagons at that time, 88s, old 88 station wagon. And there was three of us assigned to put in the second seat and the rear seats. And that rear seat was a real rough job. You had to take it off from a monorail and load it in the back end of that wagon and do all the bolting down and so forth and all the trim work around it. And it was real heavy. And there was three of us working on that. Well, at that time, about every sixth job that come down the production line was a 88 station wagon. So by the time you got out of that, got that one done and got out of it, you had to hurry back up the line and start catching the next one. Well, we had a coffee wagon back at that time. And what that was a cart that they brought around once in the morning, once in the afternoon. It had coffee and donuts and milk and so forth. And the line would shut down for 6 minutes. And that was strictly a Fisher Body thing. Fisher Body had that negotiated years and years before that. But that when they shut that line down this one particular day, we had gone from, when I first hired in there, we used nothing but electric motors. Well, we had gone to pneumatic motors at that time. And somebody, and I don't know which one of us, one of the three of us had left a motor in the back of the station wagon that we had just finished because the line shut down. We went to the wagon. Well, we got back to the job a little bit late, the line had already started, and that rubber hose had stretched to the max because that motor lodged in that seat. And that rubber hose was stretched out, and when it finally cut loose, it completely went over the top of the next job, landed on the roof of the next car, smacked that in, put a big old dent in it, bounced to the next car and took the windshield out, smashed that out, and wound up way back up the line, six jobs where we were supposed to start on the next station wagon. Well, a friend of mine, Oscar Vela, at that time, I was working with him and a fellow by the name of Wayne Navier. And they come over there, and the foreman just about went nuts and raised Cain, and they ushered Oscar right over to the office. And they started interviewing him. And we had a committee man at that time that later became our financial secretary, as a matter of fact, of the local, and that was Wayne Kinney. And Wayne was our committee man, and I thought the world of Wayne, and I thought he did a real good job. But anyway, Wayne went over there, tried to defend Oscar, and they threw Oscar out and disciplined him, threw him out for, I think it was 3 days at that time. And they never took me or Wayne Nayview over and interviewed us. But when the foreman come back, and we found out that they put Oscar out, never even interviewed us to find out what happened, I didn't know what to think to start with. I thought, well, maybe he told them that he did that or something, but really none of the three of us, I don't think at that time, really realized who did it. You know, we just was interested in going and getting something off the coffee wagon. So I kind of hold of Wayne Kennedy, the committee man, and I said, Wayne, what in the world is going on? What happened to Oscar? And he said, well, they put him out. And I said, for what? He said, well, they put him out for smashing the roof of the car and smashing the window out of the other one. I said, well, did he say he did it? And he said, no, he said he wasn't sure who did it. I said, well, they're gonna interview me or Wayne? And he said, no, I don't guess so. I guess they're going to leave it at that. I said, you're kidding me. He said, no. Right then and there, I decided that I was going to do something about getting involved with the union. So I told Wayne, I said, hey, I don't know if it was me. I don't know if it was Oscar. I don't know if it was Wayne. I have no idea which one of us did that. But it's not right. They should have took us all three over there and interviewed us. And either one of us admitted to it and took the rap, fine, or all of us, or none of us, but this isn't right. He said, would you give me a written statement to that effect? I said, you bet I will. So I sat down and wrote out a statement, signed it, and to tell you the truth, I don't remember now if they ever did make it right with Oscar, but I knew that certainly was not right. That wasn't, at that time, that was not out of the ordinary, the way that things were done with certain managers. Now, they wasn't all that way, but certain managers over there was that way.
Fantastic. So, one other thing. You're newly hired into the factory. You've been trained on your job. You know, you get to the point where you know your job well. Were there any initiation pranks, any hazings?
Well, that's interesting you say that, or ask that question. Yes, in fact, I was putting on armrest on this one job, and we had to reach way up, way, way up above our heads so you couldn't see where the stock was in the boxes and stuff to get the armrest out. And so I reached up there one time to get an armrest out, and 4 glasses of water dumped all over me. One of the guys had filled up 4 paper cups of water and put on that top box, and when I flipped that box over, the water come dousing me. They used to grease the guns an awful lot back then. And like I said, we had electric motors. They were slow, they were cumbersome, they were heavy. And you had to unhook from a rail and then hook up. You had to keep unhooking and hooking them up. And what the guys would do is they would grease the motor. You had a drill and you had a driver. And it was kind of dangerous. A lot of people, I drilled my pant leg and my legs I don't know how many times because the drills sometimes wouldn't shut off. You'd drop them down and drill your leg. But anyway, so you'd go to pick up one motor, and they might have greased it. So you got all this black grease all over your hands and stuff, and you had to clean all that up. I remember one time one of the guys I was working with decided that he was going to douse me with a bucket of water. The restrooms were between the floors, between the second floor and the, I guess you want to call it the third floor where 3XX it was. So he had to go down between the floors, down the stairway to the restrooms. Well, he had gone down there. He knew he was on break, and he knew I was the next one on break. So he went down there, and he drew a bucket of water. And he was waiting for me to come down the stairway. But I was coming down the stairway, and he could see my legs, so he knew it was me. And as soon as I rounded that corner, he doused me with a bucket of water. Well, the only thing was, in the meantime, the general foreman from the body shop had came up the stairs, and he beat me into the restroom. And he doused the general foreman. And that guy was mad. I mean, they had plant security running up and down that line the whole rest of the night, rest of that shift, to try and find out who did that. Because as soon as he seen what he did, he took off on a run. He got back up there on that line and went to work. Nobody squealed on him, so he got away with it. A lot of times, we used to have to wear screw aprons, and they would touch your apron strings on fire with a cigarette lighter or something, and it would smolder, and they would burn slow, the material that they had. And I remember one time, this one fellow I was working with, his name was Howard Holton. He touched one of the guy's apron strings off, and this fellow's name was Homer Cummins. He had just got back from Vietnam. He was a Vietnam vet. And Homer had never seen that happen, so he didn't know what was going on. Well, there's smoke all over the place, so he's turned round in a circle like a dog chasing his tail, trying to figure out what's wrong, where's that smoke coming from? It's his apron strings. And they burn all the way up to his britches before he finally figured out what the world was and got that apron off. And I mean, everybody's, of course, laughing. Or they'd take your lunch bucket and screw it down to your bench. You'd grab your lunch bucket at lunchtime and pull the handle off or something. Because you'd catch it on a dead run, the doggone thing would be screwed to the bench. But it's just things like that. Another time we had a general foreman back then. His name was Beaver Fisk. Beaver was down in the restroom. He was in one of the stalls and going to the bathroom. And one of the guys took a bunch of water, a cup of water, a large cup, and threw it over the top of the stall and doused him. And I remember him, I was just happy to be down there at the time, so he was accustomed to swearing, "You son of a gun, if I can get my pants up in time, I'll get you." And he was pretty wet when he came upstairs. But he never did find out who did it because he couldn't get his pants up in time. But a lot of things like that went on back then.
Now, you mentioned your apron strings and your belt pouches. Could you tell me what type of safety equipment were you issued back then?
Oh, I tell you. We didn't. Back at that time, I was doing a lot of trim work around the back glass and the front glass or the windshield. And back in those days, you could wear safety glasses if you requested them, but you didn't have to. And I never did like the things; they were hot, so I usually didn't wear them. Later on, I got a little wiser. Of course, they forced us into wearing them years later. But for a long, long time, there wasn't a lot of safety standards, and we didn't have to comply with a lot of safety standards or rules. And a lot of times, you really had a rough time even getting gloves to protect your hands or your fingers or anything. I mean, it was like pulling teeth to get the things that you really needed. And you avoided the things you probably should have had that you didn't want to deal with, just like I did with the safety glasses, until they finally made it a plant rule. And a lot of people got disciplined for failure to wear their glasses for a long time after that. It was something that, you know, something being imposed on you. I guess it's just human nature. You don't like to be told what you have to do. So a lot of people resisted, including myself. At that time, I watched out for the supervisor to make sure he didn't catch me with my glasses off. But anytime I could work without them, I didn't work with them.
So was your environment was fairly safe then, you'd say?
In that area of the plant, yes. It wasn't anything like the body shop. We didn't have spot welders going off all the time and all that kind of stuff. That was one of the cleaner and the safer areas of the plant to work in.
So do you recall any workplace injuries?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of workplace injuries. Just like that incident with the station wagons, somebody could have got hurt very seriously if they'd have been in the path of that gun. Fortunately, there wasn't anybody at that time. But we had a lot of people that had a lot of different kind of injuries over the time that I was in there. And, of course, when OSHA come into play and things became more stringent, I think that probably helped our injury record an awful lot.
OSHA?
Mm-hmm. Oh, excuse me. Occupational safety, I can't remember what.
Hazard agency?
Yeah, hazard agency. I think that's what it is, yeah. I don't know that well, too. When you get away from this stuff, you just start forgetting things. But anyway, the OSHA law, I think certainly helped. But unfortunately, even then, we had a lot of injuries. We still had a lot of things that went on that could have been avoided. They say every accident can be avoided, and I believe that. Like I said, I finally wised up. When I finally got involved with the union and found out what really needed to be done and started actually kind of trying to get other people to comply with things that I should have been complying with all along myself, then I started realizing the necessity of safety and the importance of it. And all of a sudden it became my job not only to start looking out for myself, but others as well. And it kind of changed my attitude a whole lot.
Uncle Dick, now did you work in trim through your whole GM career?
Well, I worked all over the plant, but I was reporting to trim every day for the most part. Finally became a final repair person. Back at that time they called it Group 25. But while I was a utility person, which was for quite a few years, I worked in the body shop, I got shipped out to paint shop, I worked all over the plant. But I reported to trim and then they'd ship me around to all the different places. And that's while I was in production. And then I got involved, like I said, with the union, and I got involved with a lot of other things. And I became quite active in the union, and I was very fortunate. I got elected as an alternate district committee person. And then I decided I wanted to see what the executive board was all about. So I ran for a trustee job, and I was fortunate enough to get elected to that. So I became a trustee, and then I got to go to the executive board meetings and find out more about what this local was all about, and the UAW. And then I ran for district committee, and I won that position, and later on was appointed as district shop committee. And from there I became a zone committee person, shop committee person, if you will. And eventually, after three tries, became chairman of the bargaining committee, and that was when Louis Schultz went on UAW staff, and then I was elected again, and shortly after that, I was asked to go on staff for the International Union. Reuben Burks at the time was our regional director, and so my last 10 years was spent as a UAW staff member for Region 1C. But I was very fortunate because I held a lot of positions in Local 602, and people were really good to me. And I just, things I never, never, ever imagined would ever happen to me. It was just a wonderful experience.
Doug Rademacher. Dick, I want to take you back into the plant. A lot of people come into the Fisher Body plant, and just like you said, when you first came in, you didn't know where you're at. You go to your job, you go to the parking lot, you go home, you go to your job. You said you got to work all over the plant. Can you tell me the first day you saw a body shop and the diverse differences in jobs? You were in an area that was somewhat safe and clean. What was your thoughts when you saw people that came in and did jobs that you saw down there. Can you share some of that thought?
Well, I would say I probably worked there, I'm going to say maybe 2 months before I really got introduced to the body shop. Excuse me. And I got shipped to the body shop. Of course, I didn't know where exactly it was or where I was going, so they sent somebody down there with me to take me down where the body shop was to the supervisor's area where they were sending me for the day. And I got down there, and I mean, they called it the jungle. There was this place where they had all these welders, people welding like crazy all over the place, welding all the bodies, sparks flying every which direction. And they were flying clear out into the aisleways and everything. And I didn't know whether to walk down the aisleway or not. I didn't know if I was going to get burned or what was going to happen to me. But anyway, that was kind of a scary thing down there for the very first time. You go down there in that body shop, and I mean, it was hard, hot, and looked like really dangerous work to me. And quite honestly, you know, I never ran a spot welder. To this day, I've never ran a spot welder. I never did get assigned to a job where I had to run a spot welder, but I did get assigned to a lot of different jobs in the body shop. Fortunately, spot welding wasn't one of them.
Well, you can see my question is, I guess, did you see how fortunate you were? And do you recognize, you said there was thousands of people working there, and here you were blessed with this great opportunity in the job, and here people come every day and face that job you can't hardly fathom. What do you think about people that face that struggle every day?
Well,
now that you went on to represent them.
I think it took a lot of stamina, a lot of stick-to-itiveness to even work in that body shop. I admired everybody that ever worked in a body shop. That was some tough place to work. In fact, I'll tell you, my brother hired in there probably a year, maybe a year and a half after I was working there. And they assigned him to the body shop immediately. And 3 days later, he called me up about 5 o'clock in the morning. And he said, can you clear me out when you go in this morning? He said, I quit. I said, what? I mean, this is a good job. You don't quit a job like this. He said, there is no way in the world I am going to work my life like that. He said, I ain't intending to die young. He said, people got to be nuts to work in that body shop. He said, they got me running 6 spot welders, and I ain't going to do it. So I said, well, yeah, I guess I can clear you out. So, and I did that day. I went to employment and told him he'd quit. They said, well, if he ever wants a job, tell him come on back. We'll hire him. Which he never did want to go back because he never wanted to be in that body shop. But, yeah, that took some kind of an individual to be able to deal with that body shop.
Thank you. And so, were there any other family members that worked in the plant or came to Lansing in the General Motors?
No, I never had any. Like I said, my brother, he worked there 3 days. That's the only family member I ever had to work there.
Just a minute. I wanted to. So, early on, I asked you about the shift you got put on. You said you were married with a child. That's why you took the job. How did that work out?
Well, it didn't work out real good. Like I said, we worked long hours, and my marriage didn't last too long. I was only married for 2 years, wound up divorced. In fact, I know I'm out of the ordinary because I was married 5 times during the time I worked at Fisher Body, so... And probably a lot of it was due to the fact that I wasn't home much. I wound up spending most of my time at Fisher Body. That was pretty much my life, like a lot of other people. So,
Earl Nicholson. So, were you starting to think of the people you worked around as like members of your family?
Oh, there's no doubt. You were like a family. you took care of each other. That's, when you were in there, I mean, you all had the common ground. You all were working in the same plant. It was all hard work. It you may have the cleaner. I may have been in a safer, more cleaner environment, but it was still real hard work. And you still had the same struggles day in and day out as everybody else did. Maybe not quite so much when you had the opportunity to work where I did, but you became a family. In fact, that's why I decided to get involved with the union, because I seen things going on in the family, if you will, that I didn't think was right, and I thought maybe I could help make a difference.
Dick, Doug Rademacher, you said you were a country boy, came to the city, and you saw a few women and a few minorities. Now you say that people became your family. Did that break down the walls of that you had? I'm sure you hadn't seen many minorities. When you started working on them, working with them and counting on them, did that break down the walls of growing up in an all-white environment?
Well, I grew up pretty much in an all-white environment, but as soon as I started working, when I worked in Battle Creek, I worked with a large number of, well, I say a large number, at that time I thought it was a large number, of people that were blacks and some Hispanics, and got to be very good friends with a lot of them. Went to outside activities and things. So I was always taught not to be discriminatory. I mean, person's a person, you know. It's the person, regardless of skin or nationality or whatever. My folks raised me that it's the person that counts. And so that was my belief from the beginning, so I probably didn't have to overcome a lot of things that some people may have had to when they hired into a place like that. So to me, we were all family in a short time because, like I said, we all had the same problems and we all shared the same types of work and had to come to the same place and all that.
Dick, I just want to go back a couple places. By you being a utility person and went to a vacation replacement, and you went all over and you went in the trim shop and the body shop, did you also work in the paint shop?
Oh, yeah. I not only worked in the paint shop, I was fortunate enough to get elected as committee man for the paint shop, even though I'd never been assigned there at that time. So I'd worked a number of jobs being shipped out to the paint shop and the cushion room. Worked in the cushion room. And basically all over the plant.
So in terms of working, and there's a couple of questions, like in terms of working, would you say that, where would you say like the best jobs were, or where would you say the worst jobs were? Were trims the preferred jobs?
Obviously. Trim was definitely the preferred jobs.
No. Did you find that you had more minorities in the body shop, at the paint shop, or the trim shop?
Oh, there's definitely more in the body shop, I think, than any place, and then the paint shop. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And now, when you worked in the paint shop, were there special health equipment that you had to wear also there?
In the paint shop, depending on what the job was, what area you were assigned to, as to what you had to wear, but in the paint shop, you had to wear, particularly later on in years, you had to wear a lot of special things for the quality of the job. They were worried about the paint and the quality of the product. They weren't so much worried for a long time, I think, about the people as they were the quality. It's just like when robotics came into play in the plant, you know, it used to get just beastly hot in there. It'd be 115, 120 degrees in there in the summertime, and that was all right. They weren't going to shut no lines down for anybody like that. But when the robots came into play, they wouldn't work under those conditions. They shut the line down. So they paid more attention there for a long time, I think, to worrying about their robots than they did their workers. But there was, in whatever part of the plant you worked in, there were specific things that you needed to wear as far as clothing or protective equipment, things of that nature, paint shop included.
Now, in terms of having your coworkers being seen as your work family, your brothers and sisters, how did you handle things like holidays? Were special things done? And then not only that, was the communication the same in all the different areas, or were some more friendlier than others because of the environment?
Well, again, I really didn't have any trouble as far as getting along with anybody in any particular area. I really didn't notice so much difference myself, so I can't really say as far as the environment. Other than I will say in the body shop, it was a lot harder to communicate because it was so doggone noisy down there, and you couldn't move around much because you had sparks flying everywhere. So you didn't get to go around and communicate with other people like you could in other areas of the plant. The body shop was more restrictive, much more restrictive.
And the paint shop had the booths, yes.
And the paint shop, they had the paint booths, and of course that was restrictive too.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the plant, which department was the largest department?
I believe the body shop was the largest department.
In terms of people or size?
It's size.
But in terms of people, you had your largest congregation of people?
No, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if the body shop, if you put hardware and soft trim together, it's probably the trim shop. Because it was the nature of the jobs there, being the, you know, trimming everything out.
Now, physically, I know as far as environment, now, could you not almost be on one side of the trim shop and almost see all the way through to the other side as opposed to the body shops and the paint shops?
Oh, yes. Yes. In trim, of course, you didn't have all the obstructions of spot welders and big machinery and all the kind of things you had to deal with there, you know, presses or whatever it may have been. In the trim shop, it was more wide open, and you could see, other than the racks, I mean, you had stock racks that was naturally in the way, but other than that, yes, you could definitely see more people for a further distance.
And my last question for right now, now you said you were married 5 times, and a lot of us due to working, so like that, did you have a tendency to work nights for a long period of time? Did you work day shifts, work both shifts, and was one more conducive to marriage than the other?
Well, like I said, when I hired in, they started me out on days. They kept me on days for 6 months. They had another fellow that had more seniority than me. He kept trying to bump me, but he didn't put in his, what they called a shift preference. So he didn't have the right to bump me off my shift. And at that time, you could put in a shift preference twice a year. So he had to wait for 6 months before he could put one in and bump me. In the meantime, my supervisor on the day shift liked me and wanted to keep me there. So he tried every kind of way to keep this guy from bumping me and putting me on the night shift. But after 6 months, I got bumped to the night shift. And after about 2 years at that time in the trim shop, I could have went back to days, and I could have probably held days for years. But I chose not to. It was kind of funny because when I went to the night shift, like I said, I've always been kind of a country bumpkin, so I wasn't into all that hippie stuff back in those days, and the long hair, and some of the stuff that went on, smoking the dope or whatever and all that. But so I go over to the night shift, and it's a whole different world. You have your supervisors around there, but you don't have general foremen. You don't have nobody in the office to deal with. You don't have the plant manager walking out on the floor. You just got each other. And I'm going over on this night shift, and the first night I walked in there, I mean, these long-haired, goofy-looking people and talking this crazy jive stuff, and I'm thinking, what in the world? How am I ever going to survive this? So to start with, I kind of kept to myself for a short time until I started kind of seeing what was going on and everything, and then I started opening up a little bit, and I found out, you know what, they ain't no different than anybody else. They're the same people. They just dress different and things like that, but they didn't. And the thing I liked about the night shift is you were more like a family on the night shift. You didn't have all that interference. I remember the first plant manager that when I hired in there was named Tom Weathorn. He was a big, tall fellow. They called him High Pockets. And I remember him coming out on the production line on the day shift and just getting mad over nothing. And he would start yelling and cussing, and he would pick up the nearest thing to him and just start throwing it at people. That's the kind of plant manager they had back at that time. Now, I'm not saying he was a bad guy. I don't really know the guy. But I know how he acted out there on the plant floor, and it just flabbergasted me to think a plant manager would be acting like that.
Dick, Gary, Judy, you said he started throwing things at people. Were these hourly people or supervisors that he threw things at?
He didn't care. He just started throwing things. If you was in the way, too bad. Watch out, because if he hits you, he hits you. That's the way it was.
Did he hit anybody that you know of? Or?
Well, you know, I know he hit one person in the foot. I can't tell you who it was. I can't remember the name.
So working nights, it was...
Working nights, it was a much more peaceful atmosphere. Like I said, it was a lot more camaraderie, if you will. And you didn't have all that management interference, I guess you'd call it. They kind of took care of each other and got the job done, however you had to get it done. If you needed to talk to somebody, like a general foreman or somebody from the day shift, or need something done in the office, you'd come in on your own time and do it, because they weren't going to accommodate you.
Dick, you said the Knights was completely different, had a different group of people. Did music come to play in the daily work life? And what was the difference? Did days listen to other things, and what did Knights do?
Well, on the day shift, back at that time, having radios was almost out of the question. If you were fortunate enough to be able to have a radio, you was keeping that thing low enough where just you were hearing it, and if a supervisor came around, you better hide it because you weren't supposed to have them. But sometime later, it got to where they were allowing radios. Now, this is on the day shift. As long as nobody complained about it. If there was any complaints, then they would make you take the radio out, or they would take it away from you. On the night shift, on the other hand, you'd walk in there, and they'd have music going and radios going away, and as long as nobody complained, it was still a privilege, but it was a more allowable privilege on the night shift. And so, you know, things were just more relaxed, and you could do things that you couldn't do on the day shift.
Dick, you said that you got involved with labor because you wanted to make life different and better for your brothers and sisters at work. During your time there, I know you were very instrumental in making some changes that helped to change the work life of the employee, the Fisher Body, the UAW workers. You want to tell us a little bit about your involvement in some of those programs and how it changed the way we did business and got employees involved?
Well, I guess there was a number of things I got involved with. We have what we call employee participation groups under QWL, which stood for Quality of Work Life. And I was fortunate enough to be on the committee when that first Quality of Work Life, I'm going to say attempt, happened in our plant. And we had a number of union officials at that time that was involved with it. Our bargaining committee was heading it up for the union. And it was risky business, especially politically for those individuals that were in leadership positions at that time. Because it was something totally new, and it was actually trying to work together with management for the benefit of everybody. And I remember we had a two-day offsite. Don Chenoweth was the plant manager at the time we had this two-day offsite. Don Brown was the chairman of the bargaining committee. And we had a two-day offsite with management, and we basically kind of aired our differences and decided that we spent a great deal of time just forming a mission statement so we could decide what it is we wanted to do, what direction did we want to head in this plant for the benefit of everybody. And we had to do a lot of soul searching, both sides. And the one thing I think was we all understood, we knew, was that we had to do business differently than what we had in the past. When I hired in that plant, probably the best way to get things done was if you could out-scream and out-cuss the foreman, or if the foreman could out-scream and out-cuss you, one of you was going to get your way, whichever one could be the most obstinate, I guess. And we realized that that kind of way of doing business just wasn't the way to do business anymore. So we knew we had to turn a corner, but we weren't just sure how we were going to do it. And we had some help from outside consultants. And eventually we had some trained consultants within the plant, of which I went through all that consulting training over the years and stuff too. I've felt very proud of that. But anyway, so we started through Quality Work Life, and it was difficult because when you were in your meetings and everybody was talking about this is the way we want to do business, and then you go back out on the plant floor and nothing out there had changed, so you kind of fell backwards into the old style of doing things. And then as a result of that, you reacted the same way you used to, management and union people a lot of times. And so each other was kind of holding the other hostage, saying, well, QWL is never going to work because nothing's changed. Well, I was one of those guys. I wanted to see it change, but when I was out on the plant floor and didn't see things changing, in fact, I stood up at one of the union meetings and read a five-page challenge, if you will, that I had put together. I upset some of the members of the bargaining committee at that time by doing that. But basically what my intentions were is to draw attention to some of the things that was going on that was not in line with what we said we were doing for QWL. And let's make a decision here. Are we going to do what we say we're going to do? Or are we going to continue talking one way and doing something another way? And I kind of ruffled the feathers of some of the leadership, but I did that every now and then myself anyway. So, and I had others do it to me later on. That was all right, too. But I felt very strongly that we all put our pants on the same way. We all had a common goal, and that's to make a living out of that plant. And if it was going to continue, then we needed to do things differently. But I also felt strongly that we needed to do things differently. We needed to start doing things differently other than just having umpteen meetings and talking about it. Well, in the meantime, when I became a zone committee man, I wasn't exactly happy with some of the things that I seen our own leadership doing, so I decided that I thought I could do a better job, so I ran for chairman, and I lost out on that. This is some time later after we'd been involved in this quality work-life process for some time. But anyway, I went back to the production line. I'd been off production line for about 10 years. And the first thing I was told by the supervisor when I got back on the production line is, well, we know you haven't done anything, you know, as far as working production stuff for 10 years, so you just take it easy and you, you know, we'll just give you some easy jobs and let you break in easy. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. I can do the same thing anybody else out here can do. Don't be babying me. I can do my job. And so they said, well, you don't have to. I said, yeah, I do have to. Because even though I went back to production, I wasn't in a leadership position, if you will. I didn't feel any differently. I mean, still, it was all the same. I wasn't no different than anybody else. And I was on utility again. That's where I went back to. So I told them, I don't want to be no different than anybody else. I want to do my job. I'll do my best. I always took pride in doing my best, whether I was on production line or whatever. because I had to live with myself. I'm not saying I always did the right thing, but I always tried to do the right thing. Anyhow, so they didn't baby me, and I got along just fine. But fortunately, and Louis Schultz was the chairman at that time that I had run against and lost, and Al Presley was the president of the local at that time, and Louis asked me up to his office one day. I'd been back on production, I think, about 4 or 5 months. And he asked me if I would consider taking a job. They were going to make an appointment pretty soon, and he wanted to know if I'd be interested in it. And I said, well, it depends on what it is. He said, well, we need somebody in training. We need a production training coordinator. And I said, oh, well, what's that? So he started explaining, you know, somebody to kind of work with some of the management people and the union people, involve with training, and kind of oversee the thing for production people, not for skilled trades, but for production. And I said, yeah, I might be interested. He said, well, it would be kind of foolish for me to appoint somebody that might turn around and run against me again. Oh, wouldn't it? I said, well, that's your choice, Lou. I said, I'm getting along just fine on the production line. And I don't have no problem being there. I said, if you're looking for a commitment out of me, you can go get it, because I'm going to do what I think is right at the time. And I said, if I think I should run again, I'm going to. And if I don't think I should, I won't. Well, so I didn't hear no more until I'd been on the production line for about 10 months. And Louis and Al Presley came out on the production line, pulled me into the supervisor's office, had me covered with a relief person, and offered me that production coordinator job. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's how I met Cheryl McQuaid, because she worked down there with the training folks at the time. And so, anyway, I was offered the job. I took it, no strings attached. And I had a lot of training to help me do my job, a lot of expensive training. And I felt real fortunate to do that. And it was a while later, I think I was production training coordinator about a year or maybe a little more or something like that, when they got a hold of me and wanted to know, specifically, I guess it was Louis Schultz got a hold of me, and wanted to know if I'd get involved with something else. They wanted me to, it was a new position they really didn't know too much about, and he told me quite frankly, he said, it's an impossible job. We know that nobody can do it, but on the other hand, we figured if anybody would try, you would. So he said, that new job coming up called simultaneous engineering rep. We want to know if you'd be interested in it. I didn't even know what the heck that was, so I said, well, what is it? He said, so he explained, well, it's getting hourly involvement in future products. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I'll give it a try if you want me to. No strings attached. So he said, okay. So anyway, I wound up taking that. They appointed me to that job, and I worked with a number of people. We had what we called product development teams, and what that was is PDTs, acronym we used, and what that was is we jointly selected people to work on forward planning projects for future cars that we were going to build, or somebody was going to build, hopefully us. That was the whole thrust of it. And our hourly folks went down and spent a lot of time down at Warren with the engineers. And we had what we called 19 product development teams when I left that particular position. And I was real proud of that. We held meetings weekly, usually a couple of meetings a week. And it was my job just to coordinate it. We had a lot of very, very good dedicated people on the hourly side that were selected. We used a selection process that we thought was a fair process. In fact, we selected people that I never thought, knowing some of those people, I never thought we'd select them for anything. And other people I didn't know, naturally you'd think they wouldn't get selected for something, but those are the people that did get selected because we used the process and we found out. Fortunately, I found out how important using processes are when I was in the training department. Using processes is very important. But anyway, so we started gaining a lot of recognition, our plant, because of working so closely with the engineers down in Warren. And it was all because of these people and their involvement and their dedication. And when I say dedication, they were dedicated to the product and dedicated to the people in the plant. And it was really a great thing, I think, when Jim Zupkus became our plant manager, because Jim Zupkus invited me to his staff meetings. He had staff meetings every day. And as chairman, he invited me to those staff meetings. And I didn't make them all, but I made as many of them as I could. And he told me when he invited me, he said, there's going to be things said in there you're not going to like, you're not going to agree with. And he said, I'm not asking you to. He said, all I want you to do is be open and honest. He said, there's things in there that you're going to say that we're not going to like as managers. But he said, that's how we're going to do business, because we need to communicate and we need to go forward. And the way we're going to make things better is to bring things out in the open and deal with them. And he was true to that. That's the kind of thing he did. In fact, Jim Zupkus was out on the floor all over that plant a large amount of the time while he was plant manager. I had a lot of respect for Jim Zupkus. I think he genuinely was interested in not only the product and furthering the plant, but the people. He understood the people is what made that plant.
Do you feel that having those types of programs and having hourly workers doing non-traditional jobs and being involved in non-traditional, decisions, is that something that you feel that was instrumental in making Lansing that capital of quality?
Well, I think it was, in that time frame, I think it was absolutely a necessity. I don't think we would have survived if we hadn't done some things differently. And the engineers, our people gained a lot of knowledge working down there in Warren with those engineers and interacting with the engineers as well as the management folks in the higher echelon, I guess you'd say, in our plant. And they learned, they gained mutual respect for each other because they started gaining knowledge of each other's ways and how they interrelated, just how much alike we were rather than how different we were. And the whole focus, of course, was on the product, but that focus turned out to be a little more intimate between people than what just the product was. And it was great when I remember the first time that we brought engineers into the plant to work out on the production line with the hourly people out there. Because those engineers, they were down there and they were kind of untouchable to the hourly workforce. And they were doing the best job they could. But they didn't realize when they were engineering something in Warren, what kind of effect that had on the person that actually had to build the product back there in Lansing. And they really had some eye-openers when they went out there on that production line and started working on things that they had engineered. And they said, how in the world? You can't twist your wrist four different kind of ways to do this. Well, that's what we've been trying to tell you guys. But we're going back and re-engineer this thing. It was great. It was great for the product. It was great for the union management relations. Everybody started, I think, gaining a whole lot more respect for the others.
Again, about the Lansing workforce. Do you think that because we were that unified family, slightly different from other workers, did the factor of the way we treated each other, the way we interacted with each other, did that have an impact on that type of project?
it had an impact, I think, not only on that particular kind of that project, but all projects. It didn't matter where I went. It didn't matter if I was sitting in a meeting in Warren, Michigan with managers, or if I was sitting in a meeting in Detroit with the higher-ups in the International Union, or where I was. You heard nothing but good things about Local 602 and Lansing. And Lansing workforce in general. It wasn't just Local 602. It was Local 652. It was 1618. Lansing was looked at very favorably, and it was because we had actually shown the rest of the industry, if you will, at least within Michigan, how management and union could cooperate with each other and could be successful doing that. And we gained a lot of recognition. The people in the plant, I don't think, ever really realized just how important those things were and just how much that helped to secure their future. You know, we still had people that sat back and lobbed grenades, if you will, and you got to expect that anyway. But overall, Lansing was looked at so favorably. I remember we negotiated the JCAR agreement and they were going to roll it out. So they held a special news conference. And I remember Steve Jokic came to town for that, and he's sitting up on the stage. We hadn't even ratified the agreement yet, and he didn't know that. He thought it was a done deal, ratified and everything, and here they're making a big news splash all over about what Lansing just did to get the JCAR. And something was said when Jokic was up there, and he turned around and he said, "We do have this agreement ratified, don't we?" We said, "No, not yet, but we're going to have." He didn't know what to do at that point because he wouldn't have been there without a ratification. But we felt strongly enough, you know. I mean, it was ratified. It was nip and tuck. It wasn't by a whole lot. I think it was like 51-52% or something like that. But the whole shop committee went right out on the floor, and we held meetings day and night. And met with all the departments, all the people, and explained all of these things. You could take it for what it was worth to you as an individual, but at least we was going to go out there and let you know about it and let you make an informed decision on whether you wanted that or not. But we felt very strongly that was the future of our plant in our hands, and we had to do whatever. And we didn't give up a lot, I want to say, if you want to take a look at in the long run. But the JCAR and the NCAR were things that were very controversial when we had to negotiate agreement to get those things. I remember management wanted to negotiate with 602 and 652 together. Well, 602 and 652, we worked together, but on the other hand, we didn't want to negotiate our agreements together. We were two separate groups, and we wanted to stay two separate groups. We wanted to stay two separate local unions. So we were reluctant, but on the other hand, we knew we had to do something. If management wanted to negotiate that way, we had to do something because we needed that agreement to get that product. So we met together, and at that time, Art Baker was chairman at 652, and I was chairman at 602. And so when we got in at the bargaining table, when we sat down with negotiations, Art and I had already worked together some anyway. And quite frankly, not everybody was trusting Art from 602, and probably not everybody was trusting me from 652. But we knew we had to do that, so we sat down with management. And the first thing I tried to do is to find out what it is management was looking at. So I started asking questions about, well, what is it you want to negotiate on? And they started talking about these various things, of which... One of the big things was the six-minute shutdown time for a coffee wagon twice a day. That was a huge, huge issue because we were the last plant in the world to have that, from my understanding. And it had been a tradition for Fisher Body for many, many years. And originally when management started talking that, I said, "You mean the 12 minutes or do you mean just pushing the cart out on the floor?" And originally they said, "No, we're not talking about... the 12 minutes. We're just talking about the cart." We're not going to take your time away. We don't want to take your time away. What we want to do is keep the production line working and give you more tag relief time for the 6 minutes. Well, by the time we got around to sitting down for negotiations, they wanted the 12 minutes. And, of course, that was a real tough issue. In fact, years later, I was talking to Don Brown and over here to the Union Hall, and Don told me, he said, well, you know, they came after us every year for that, every negotiations, and he said, we should have took care of that years before, but he said it was just too hot of a political issue, and we just didn't think we could weather the storm. So nobody ever dealt with it. But anyway, during my tenure, we dealt with it all right. We didn't like to, but we wound up making an agreement whereby we didn't have that 12 minutes, we didn't have that coffee wagon anymore. And like I said, we finally got an agreement, reached an agreement, very controversial, but we got it, and we got the product. We did what we had to do at the time. It was kind of interesting to me, though, because we all went out, the bargaining committee, we went all over the plant before we ever signed any of the tentative agreement sheets with management over that issue. And we talked to people and we said, okay, here's what they want. And we knew the coffee wagon was going to be the big issue. The 12 minutes was going to be the biggest issue to deal with. We said, how do you feel about it? And I talked to people that I'd worked on the line for years about that issue. And they said, to heck with it. Give it up. We want a product. I said, you mean keep the 12 minutes, just get rid of the cart? No, no, no. If you got whatever you got to do, if you got to give up 12 minutes, we want that job. We want a future here. Okay. Well, it's kind of interesting because after we finally had signed the agreement and took it out for ratification, those same individuals, I just sold us down the river. I'd say, well, what are you talking about? I talked to you personally. I didn't ever say that. Okay, if that's what you didn't say, that's fine, but I remember it that way. Regardless, here's what we've got. You can vote for it or against it. It's up to you. And you can believe that our future's hanging in the balance on this issue or not. That's up to you, too. That's why we have to take the issue back out to you, because it's no more my future than it is yours. It's everybody's. You're the ones, no matter what we negotiate, membership's got to ratify it.
So is the NCAR getting that there under your watch, is that one of the things that you were most proud of as a bargaining chair?
Definitely. I think the again, like I said, I think to this day, I think the future of the plant was really at risk at that point in time. And I think we did what we had to do. I think the membership, I mean, the reason they ratified those things is because they did realize that. Nobody likes to give up something like that. That was very important. It was very important to me.
What would you say would be one of your worst memories that you had?
Probably the incident I talked about earlier, off record, involving a gun incident in an interview when I was a district committee man. There was an individual that had come from another plant and came into this plant and really wasn't used to doing production work, if you will, and had quite an attitude about it, and fortunately wound up going back to his previous plant when all was said and done. Thankful for that, but anyway, this particular incident, what happened is this individual had done something wrong. I don't even recall what it was now in management's eyes, but they had held an interview. They were going to discipline this person. So they called me to represent them, and I got over to the office, and they got in between the general foreman and the individual, they got in a heated name-calling contest, which totally shocked me, particularly with the general foreman, because I'd known him for years, and he was really an easygoing, soft-spoken, nice guy. I I've never seen him react like this, but they got into name calling and pounding fists on the desk and threatening each other and all kinds of stuff. Make a long story short, when the whole thing ended up, this guy ran out of the plant and I followed him. He was parked out in front. When I walked out the door, he was popping his trunk open. I ran over to where he was standing. He reached in a bag and pulled out a pistol. And I told him he wasn't going to go back in that plant. He wasn't going to use that pistol and all this kind of stuff. Because he had threatened to kill this general foreman. This general foreman had threatened him, different things. But anyway, fortunately... Like I said, I was kind of talking to him like a preacher at that time, but he finally cooled down enough. He put the gun back away. He closed the trunk. He said he wasn't going back in the plant, which I was glad of at that time. First, I told him he had to come back in the plant. I was going to fire him, but after I see what he was doing, I didn't want him back in the plant. But anyway, and he drove off, and I don't recall exactly whatever became of that whole thing at Fisher Body, but I do remember that he got... Shortly thereafter, got called back to his previous plant, and he didn't lose his job. So.
Was that type of incident a rare occasion? Is that a really isolated incident of things like that happening in the factory?
Well, I don't want to say it was necessarily isolated incident, but I'm going to say it was rare things like that happening to that extent. I know there were other incidences, some of them I wasn't involved with, where there were things... It could have turned out violent. I remember one time we had one of our members that had called in and threatened to kill myself and everybody in the work center and the plant and the president over to Union Hall. So the plant had gotten a hold of the police department. The police department had... told them to get a hold of us. They called us into labor relations and they notified us of the threat, told us to stay away from this person, and they had police around the plant trying to apprehend this person if they tried to enter the plant and all that. Nothing ever happened during the shift that day, so when I walked out to my vehicle after the end of the shift, went down and locked the door, this individual that had made the threats come out from behind my car and naturally startled me. I didn't know if he had a gun or what. But as it turned out, it's another thing that it didn't turn out bad. He didn't do anything bad as far as hurting anybody. We got him some counseling, and he went on to eventually retire. So something that could have been bad turned out okay.
Doug Rademacher. Dick, one, I want to touch on, you were talking about the J and the N car. This was Fisher Body in Lansing is also known for an Olds town. Can you share the change of those particular car models? That had a huge impact. What exactly were these products, and wasn't that a piece of the problem as what we were going to be breaking away from our heritage?
Yeah, that was a big piece of the problem, too, because historically we had built Oldsmobiles. In fact, from the time I hired in, that's pretty much all we had built was Oldsmobiles. We built the 88, the 98, the F-85 station wagon, the F-85 Olds, the 88 station wagon. We built the convertibles, and this was Oldsmobile. Lansing was known for Oldsmobile. And we had Oldsmobile headquarters here in town. And Oldsmobile was everybody's bread and butter for all those years. And suddenly everything shifted from large cars to small cars. And we didn't see where that was going to be such a good thing for us. First of all, from a work standpoint, supposedly those small cars took a whole lot less manpower, which means we were going to lose a lot of our membership. So that was a concern for us because we didn't want to see our friends or family members, if you will, get laid off, lose their jobs. Secondly, because even from the local union standpoint, that could be a real financial problem for us with less union dues coming in. So that was another big concern from a local standpoint. But just the idea of having to make that change was something that, again, people a lot of times resist change. And that was a huge change. That was a huge change for anybody that had worked for any length of time here at Fisher Body. And other areas of the plant, or other areas of town too, of course. So it was a, kind of a natural resistance to that. We were going into some uncharted waters, and we just didn't know if that was the right thing to do. Particularly the people I think out on the floor, they didn't know if that was a wise decision. What they really wanted to do was keep doing what we've always done: build big cars and make good cars, and just keep plowing forward. But naturally, the corporation didn't have that in mind. They had other things in mind. They were going to put small car products somewhere. And if they were going to go to small car products, we wanted to be the ones that was going to get them. If they were going to phase out the big cars, we wanted the small cars, from a leadership standpoint anyway. And it was a big, big issue. Not only for the folks in the union, but management people as well. I mean, that was their livelihood as well. But you had a lot of supervisors and so forth that's all they knew was building big Oldsmobiles. So they were worried about their future, too.
There's another group that we haven't touched on yet, and I want you to share the difference between the assembly line worker in all those departments and the skilled trades arena. And the challenge to move that group of workers, and I know that had a lot of battles for you there too.
Skilled trades was a battle, all right, because it was a big issue. Skilled trades have what they call lines of demarcation, and as things progressed over the years, it became a big issue as far as negotiations was concerned, because you had electricians that their particular jobs were dealing with specific things. You had millwrights, their particular jobs were dealing with specific things, and all the other trades as well. We had a number of skilled trades in our plant. I think back at that time, I think we had something like 17 clearly defined different skilled trades. And nobody wanted anybody else working in their turf. I mean, that was the way it was. You didn't want anybody else taking your work away from you, because that was jeopardizing your futures, possibly. And so that was a big issue when other plants started doing these things, and, of course, a lot of non-union places have always done those kind of things, overlapping. And then we had Local 1618 over here. In order to survive, they had to enter into an agreement whereby they broke down those lines of demarcation, and they had skilled trades people in there doing all kinds of things that normally they wouldn't have been allowed to do, because it didn't belong in their trade, it belonged in another trade. And that became a big issue here in Lansing site, not just Local 602, but Lansing. But in order to survive, they had to negotiate those kind of agreements. They didn't want to, but they had to. They realized it. Their membership realized it. They ratified the agreements. The International Union realized it. They sanctioned those agreements. And it made it tougher on the rest of us that didn't necessarily have to go into those kind of agreements at that time, because it put a lot of pressure on us. In fact, we had a number of membership meetings where our own members stood up and were very upset with the leadership of Local 1618 for doing those kind of things. And, we tried to explain. I tried to explain to them when I was chairman. You got to put yourself in their shoes. When you're walking in their shoes, what would you do differently? And quite frankly, I don't think we'd have done a bit of things differently. I think we'd been doing the same as what they had to do. And so that pressure was always on us from that point forward, particularly after they'd finally got it in one area in this town, They wanted to always do that. Well, then we realized, too, some of that stuff just didn't make sense. It didn't make sense for an electrician to stop working on something to have a millwright come out and move something that the electrician could have picked up and set over there 2 feet. It didn't amount to nothing. It really wasn't taking anybody's work away. So we formed a committee. It was a joint committee of our skilled trades workforce later on. And their skilled trades guys selected their own representatives from the various trades, the major trades at that time, to work with management on trying to call out, if you will, those kind of things that didn't make sense to keep clearly defined within a particular trade. And they did a lot of work. It was tough. It was hard for those individuals. It was very political in some situations. It made it tough for the leadership. Of course, I guess that's one thing the committees helped to do was kind of take some of the edge off from the leadership as far as the politics of it all. But it still all pointed back to the leadership because those committees were basically doing the work of the leadership. They were doing what the leadership's responsibilities were. If you're going to do the job right, you get the experts involved, and that's the people that's out there doing the work. That's one thing we always tried to convince management of. If you really want the job done right, you know, you can either do it management's way or you can do it the right way. I used to tell everybody, you know, the better, you got a foreman that's giving you a problem, and I practiced this when I was on a production line. You got a foreman that's giving you a problem, the best way to break them down is do exactly what they tell you. Because they can't live with doing what they tell you.
Dick, a lot of people don't understand that within the union, we're all union represented, but we voted individually. The trades arena and the general production had separate ballot boxes also. And so those things were... it was very difficult to keep everybody happy. Isn't that true with where they could actually vote in the opposite direction of the... they could hold you hostage, is something, I guess is what I want to say.
Well, it really wasn't difficult. It was impossible to make everybody happy. And you didn't have to be in a leadership position very long to figure that out. You couldn't make everybody happy. The best thing you could try and do is what was best for the majority and hope that the majority carried the ball, ratified your agreements and lived with your agreements and hope that you could keep management line living. You always had to constantly remind management, this isn't a union contract. This is a management union contract. We both agreed this is the way we're going to do business together. And, you know, Reuben Burks, years and years ago, long before everyone on the international staff, said something that always stuck in my mind. We were over here at the Union Hall. We were in a training class, bargaining class. And Reuben came in, and we were just going into negotiations, and it was going to be a tough set of negotiations. We knew that. And Reuben spoke for a while, and then in his closing remarks, something that I will never forget probably to the day I die. He told us, he said, one thing you never want to do. Do not force management into agreeing to something that they can't live with. Because they won't. You can put it in writing, but if they can't live with it, you're going to be the bad guy. Because you can't make them live with it. And all you can do is write grievances and everything. And you're the bad guy because you can't make them do what they already said they'd do. So I always kept that in mind when I was in negotiating, whether it was grievance settlements or contracts. And that is, you got to consider their position and what they're able and not able to do at the same time you're negotiating with them. You don't force them into something they can't live with, because they ain't going to live with it.
Well, Dick, you that leads you into a story, I think. Groups in the plant could control the work environment or the production. And you talk about maybe an incident about something in the cushion room, or where they were able to control the flow of the production.
Yeah, the cushion room was known as the rowdy group in the plant for a long time. They had a couple of incidences I remember that actually shut the plant down. One of them was a walkout where they just flat walked out, and is what they call a work stoppage, which if you were caught by our agreement, our national agreement, if you were caught leading a work stoppage, by the terms of the agreement, you could not only be fired, but the union couldn't negotiate you back to work. And but some of those individuals, the conditions were not good out there in that cushion room. And some of those individuals took it upon themselves to bring it to management's attention by walking off the job. Another incident, they had what they called a Blue Monday. And what that was is a bunch of people called in sick on a Monday, so they couldn't even start up. And in fact, we had two individuals that later became well known and I think well respected union leaders that not only probably played a part in that, but were disciplined for that. In fact, they were both on 5 years probation as a result of that. Management felt that they had headed that whole thing up and convinced other people to go along with it. They held a lot of interviews for a long time. And to make a long story short, what finally was agreed to for those two individuals, and I always thought this was a strange agreement, but it's what came out of it. They did not admit to doing anything like that, but on the other hand, it was negotiated that what would happen, they would be on 5 years probation, put back to work, and given their back pay. So they were paid their back pay for the time they were off on discipline and put on 5 years probation. And I have a lot of respect for both those people yet today. In fact, one of them I love her dearly. As Dorothy Stevens, and you've probably been in his interviews, have heard that name more than once. Dorothy was somebody that, when I first came on the committee, I looked up to. She was an individual that didn't hesitate to let her position be known on something, and she didn't hesitate to back it up. And whether she was right or wrong sometimes, she didn't back off until you proved her wrong. And Dorothy, for as many problems as she gave some management people, was highly respected by management. And in fact, there was more than one occasion that I know of for a fact that management tried to convince her to jump over to their side and take a position in management. I even had a couple instances of that myself when I was in there. I was offered a labor relations job one time, and I was offered a supervisory job with a guarantee within 6 months I'd be a general foreman. And I turned them both down because I wasn't interested in being a management person. I was interested in being a union rep. That's what I was doing. That's what I wanted to do. But Dorothy was looked upon, I think, as the kingpin of that whole business out there in the cushion room, and she paid the price for it, and willingly so. In fact, I remember a few years later, she was she was the shop committee person. She was the first woman on the shop committee. And no doubt in my mind, could have been the chairman of this local anytime she wanted to run for it, I think, after that. But Dorothy wasn't interested in that. Obviously, she was just interested in trying to take care of the people. That's what she was all about. But I remember that 5 year probation, these two individuals couldn't be involved with anything that even faintly resembled a work stoppage. And we had our Olds haul drivers that hauled the bodies between Fisher Body and Olds And Dorothy represented those individuals when she was on the shop committee. And I remember they were a couple times that they were going to do a work stoppage. And of course, for her to protect herself, she had to tell them, you know, you can't do that. I mean, in an official capacity. Now, what she did in an unofficial capacity was probably support them individuals, but her job was in jeopardy, and they didn't want to see her lose her job, so they had to kind of work with her on some of those things. But Dorothy was highly respected by the people that she represented and by management that she actually negotiated against.
Dick, you shared that you were offered, and Dorothy possibly offered a job in management. Just brings to the mind of mine, I've only heard some stories, but what about a guy named Rocky Wright? Wasn't he a union activist that did turn the other side?
Yeah, Rocky Wright was a person that was involved with the union. He was a union representative, and they had an incident, and the story goes, no, I wasn't there. I did talk to Rocky several times later on when he became a management person, when he was a general foreman, about the incident. Now, the story has it that Rocky Wright laid down in front of a truck and wouldn't let him through the gate while they were on a work stoppage. And Rocky always denied that. But I also talked to people that were there at the time, and they say that's exactly what he did. But be that as it may, let's say that he did do that. That was very risky business. He could have easily lost his job. But it's kind of ironic because rather than lose his job later on, he became a management person, became a supervisor, became a general foreman, eventually a superintendent in the plant.
Dick, Gary, Judy, I just want to know if it changed their working conditions for the people in the cushion room that did have the work stoppage. Did it improve their working conditions?
As a matter of fact, it did. Now, there were some hardcores out there that you weren't going to change a whole lot as far as some of the management thinking out there. They had some tough managers out there. They were not good people to work for. And that's, of course, what caused the upheaval to begin with. But it did change a lot of the conditions. It wasn't all for naught. They were successful in helping people out there in a number of ways, I guess. Now, I didn't work out there at that time with any regularity, so I can't tell you all the ins and outs. But I do know, and I'm going to revert back a little bit to Dorothy Stevens as an example. They gave her fits afterwards because they knew they had her in a bind following that incident. And they even had gone to the extent of trying to intimidate her and doing things that would try and break her down, if you will, because she's a very strong-willed lady. She was then, she is yet today. But even to the point of, I remember telling one time about they assigned her assignment was to guard the drinking fountain in the cushion room. Now, can you imagine staying out there 8 or 9 hours a day watching a drinking fountain? That's your job for the day? And first of all, it's meant to humiliate her, intimidate her. And secondly, that in itself is going to be a long, long day, standing there watching a doggone drinking fountain. And she had to do this day after day. And it's just things like that. They tried all kinds of tactics to try to break her down. And not just her, other leadership, I'm sure, went through similar things. But the cushion room was noted for probably being more innovative with those kind of things because of some of the tight management they had out there.
So, speaking of management, in your opinion, and the different positions that you've held, a wide variety of them, being a union representative, a production worker, international rep, what makes a good manager, a manager and a bad manager? Can you tell us what the
Well, I guess I gotta go with the golden rule. You know, if you treat people the way you want to be treated, I think you're going to be a good manager. If you put yourself in their shoes and you don't ask them to do something you wouldn't do yourself, and if you're open to suggestions and if you're willing to look at the individuals doing the work as the expert and giving them some involvement, some input into what's going on in their life, you're going to find out. Those people are interested in making things work and making them work well because that's their livelihood. They're not out to try and give management a rough time. Management has caused their own problems over the years. That's why we have a union. It's because of management. Bad managers make good unions. Now, to me, I have worked for good managers in that plant and I've worked for bad managers. And I've gone out of my way to give fits to bad managers. And I've tried to do it in such a manner where I wasn't going to get hurt, but they wasn't going to be happy when it was all over. And I've been pretty successful in certain instances. On the other hand, I have gone in the other direction for good managers, and I've gone way, way beyond the call of duty to try and make them look good because I knew what they were trying to do was for my benefit and the other workers that I worked with. Sometimes they weren't even going along with a contract, but they were doing it. When they were breaking the contract, they were doing it for the benefit of the workers to try and help them out. And that's the difference between a good manager and a bad manager, I think. Put yourself, if a good manager puts themselves in the shoes of the person they're managing, they're going to be all right.
Dick, I'm going to move you on to benefits. What is your most appreciated bargain benefit that you've benefited from over these years?
Well, I'll say right now, my pension. Before I retired, it was something else. It was my wages and my benefits, naturally. And, of course, health care being the big issue for the last 25 or more years now. That's a big, big issue. And I, myself, with all of my medical problems I've experienced over the years, as well as my family members, I know that if I had to pay those bills, it'd be in excess of $1 million. So health care is a big, big issue. But I'm very thankful for the pension that's been negotiated, for the wages that I was fortunate enough to make over the years that was negotiated, and for the benefits.
Did you use the tuition assistance program for your children or aided for the children in their schooling?
Well, I didn't. My one, and I can't recall all the details right now, my one son tried to and he was unsuccessful because there was something there he didn't qualify for and I can't remember what it was. Myself, I used the tuition assistance as far as a lot of training that I received from both the GM and the UAW. So as far as my family members, though, they weren't either able to or didn't apply for tuition assistance.
Doug Rademacher again. Dick, did you find yourself involved more in the political arena from being a union rep? And has it carried over into your community? Can you share some stories and how you've moved on?
Yeah, I've first of all, being involved with the union made me aware. Attending union meetings made me aware of what was going on in politics, both locally, statewide, and on a national scale. It made me aware of a lot of issues and various people's positions on those issues that were running for office that I otherwise probably wouldn't have paid any attention to, but because I didn't before that. And, of course, now my kids, when it comes time, other than, unfortunately, I got a couple of stepsons that I don't seem to be able to persuade sometimes, but my kids, it's not unusual for them prior to an election call me up and say, "Dad, who are you voting for and why?" you know, and so I will tell them. I don't tell them how to vote, but I tell them who I'm voting for and why. And I think that's had an influence on my children as far as, and as far as their participation. Because if I hadn't have talked politics and tried to inform them of the importance of politics and stuff, they may not even voted at all. And I remember my my third oldest daughter, when she was going to school, she was telling me about the great debates that she got into with her teacher. Lived in a predominantly Republican area. Her teacher was obviously a Republican. And, of course, historically, the Democratic platform seems to go much more toward the working concerns than what Republican platforms do. And so she would debate this teacher on a lot of issues. And she felt confident in debating those issues because I had talked to her about those issues and who her people stood on them. And she used to come home and say, "Dad, we talked about this, and that teacher said this and that, and I fixed him up. I told him he don't know what he's talking about." And she said, "I corrected him." So overall, I think it's had a real positive impact, not only on myself as far as politics, but my kids as well.
Dick, would you share your, you have a passion, a hobby, and it carries over from the talent shows we've had, and now I've seen you do this particular activity, gatherings in Flint, Michigan, and now you carry on today. So would you share what that is?
Well, I like to pick and grin a guitar a little bit and other things, but I've country music's always been something that's near and dear to me. I like other kinds of music too, but country's been my favorite. I love country and love gospel. And we've had a number of benefits over the years that me and various other people either had a band or formed a band for specific reasons have performed for. And I played at the local union picnic before with a band a couple times, two or three times, I don't remember. We have played for fundraisers. We've played for political rallies. And most recently, since I've retired and moved up north, I've kind of fell into a group of people that we've been playing for fundraisers up there to help people out that are less fortunate, particularly people that don't have healthcare coverage and had some real medical problems and very big expenses. And so we've been playing for fundraisers trying to help people. Like a 15-year-old boy had cancer and his folks couldn't afford to pay the bill, and a lady that suffered with congestive heart disease and big hospital bill, couldn't afford that. Things of that nature.
Okay. Well, we see this plant close and you're here today, and I know you brought a camera. The Fisher body is coming down. General Motors has invested quite a sum of money out here for a new product and a new plant. What's your feelings on the closing, on the future, and what do you tell young people about the future?
Well, from a personal standpoint, I can tell you it's sad to me, first of all, to see the plant having to be destroyed. I mean, that's a place where it helped me grow up, let's put it that way. I might have already been grown up, so to speak, when I got there, but it helped me grow up. All the people in it helped me grow up. And so it becomes a real important part of your life going there all those years, and so many people that I was fortunate enough to work with, to represent. And I think back of all the people that, in fact, I've seen a lot of people pass over the years, young and older, that I worked with. And I hate to see it. On the other hand, I also am glad that they're building a new plant, that our members are going to have a future in working in that new plant. And so, you know, it's kind of good and bad, mixed feelings there. But I bought the camera for two reasons, actually. To take some pictures of the old plant over there, and the other is to take a picture of this committee, because I think what you're doing is a wonderful thing. I kind of envy you, because I know you already told me you've heard some great stories, and I know you're going to hear some great stories further in the future as you continue on this process, and that's great. I've been involved with enough things, interviewing people for selection of different positions and all kinds of things that really make you appreciate people, and you learn things about people you never imagined just sitting in there. Just being in that plant working with somebody, you don't really know people. You know them from a working standpoint, and that's all. When you find out things that they're involved with on the outside, or how they really are in family life, or things of that nature, it's, you just get a whole different perspective on individuals. I've seen some people that, I'll tell you quite frankly, I thought pretty rotten people in that plant. I found out they're just wonderful people. It's the atmosphere in the plant that caused them to do the things they do or act the way they acted. Because when they got out of there, they're some of the nicest people you ever met in the world. It's a whole different environment. It's a different life for them. So I envy you in a lot of ways, what you're going through now. I'm sure you're going to enrich your lives, and I'm sure you already have in this process. As far as young people, I think, and I hate to say this, but I think on an overall scale from what I see out there, there's a whole different work ethic today than there used to be when I hired in that plant. When I hired in that plant, you knew that you had to work for a living for the rest of your life. So you might as well get in there and do the best you can. If you're going to make it good for yourself, you're going to have to make it good for somebody else who's going to make it good for you. And you knew that, and you didn't back away from work. You got in there and you did what had to be done. It wasn't always fun, and it wasn't always easy, but it's just what you had to do, and you did it. I see a lot of attitude in some of our younger people nowadays, and I'm not trying to put everybody in a basket here, the same basket, but I just see so much more of it. I think that they have an attitude that if it's going to get me dirty, I ain't going to do it. If I got to get up too early in the morning, I ain't going to do it. If I'm not going to make big money at it, I'm not going to work at all. And, you know, it's just, I don't know what the attitude, why the change, and maybe some of it, I think a lot of it probably, I've heard other people say this, and looking back, you're probably right, but maybe we've done too much for our children or whatever, to the point where they think that they don't have to do all those kind of things, because we would be maybe being overprotective and trying to do too much for them, so they didn't have to do the things. They didn't have to suffer like we had to suffer. They didn't have to work as hard as we had to work. They didn't have to put up with conditions like we had to put up with. So they don't expect they should ever have to do that. And there just may come a time when they have to do that. So my advice to young people is, whatever you got to do, put your mind to it, put your body to it, get in there and get the job done, and take pride in whatever it is. I don't care what you do. My folks always taught me, it doesn't matter what you do in life. And my grandfather told me, it doesn't matter what you do. If it's worth doing, it's worth doing right. Give it your best.
Thanks, Dick.
Thank you, Dick.
Thanks, Dick. Thanks, Dick. Thanks, Dick. Great interview. Thank you.